Well, 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 compromise is possible. We'll look at what that $1 trillion infrastructure bill means for coping with climate change. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Avon, Colorado, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 10th of August. Good to have you with us. The bipartisan infrastructure package the Senate passed today now goes to the House. In its current form, the bill directs billions of dollars to address climate change, including wildfire prevention and resilience. Last year was a record-setting year for fires in the U.S. Today, more than 100 large active fires are burning, mostly in the West, with months left to go of peak fire season. And as that UN climate report confirmed yesterday, an even hotter future is all but certain. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Almost every year now, it seems, wildfires are setting records. Just the other day, the Dixie Fire became the second largest in California history.
And the cost is going to just go up over time. And we're talking about billions of dollars of lost property and economic activity.
Amy Myers Jaffe is with the Climate Policy Lab at Tufts University. She says the actual dollar amounts in the infrastructure bill specifically for wildfire mitigation are relatively small, but
it's an important acknowledgement that this is a major challenge for the United States and we need to address it in a multifaceted way.
If the bill passes the House as is, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration would get millions of dollars to put toward better fire forecasting.
The bill would significantly increase funding for the Department of the Interior and the Forest Service for a range of activities that can decrease communities' risks to wildfires.
Laura Brush at the nonprofit Center for Climate and Energy Solutions says that includes things like forest restoration, prescribed burns, and better planning. Michael Mann, an atmospheric scientist at Penn State University, says all that will help to some degree. But ultimately, preventing more extreme wildfires means moving away from fossil fuels.
In the absence of that large-scale shift away from fossil fuel burning, there are no resiliency measures that are going to insulate us.
He says only clean and renewable energy can do that. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Up next in the Senate is the $3.5 trillion budget resolution Democrats unveiled yesterday, which, unlike the infrastructure bill, looks likely to face solid Republican opposition. The resolution includes a big expansion of safety net programs, including help for families with kids in daycare and universal pre-kindergarten for 3- and 4-year-olds. Most states have some form of publicly funded pre-K, but as Marketplace's Amanda Peacher reports, universal access would be a big lift for taxpayers.
For many 3- or 4-year-olds, pre-K is the real start to their education. Sometimes its benefits are noticeable right away. Anna Jimenez saw her 3-year-old daughter's speech impediment improve last year after she started publicly funded preschool in New Jersey.
She was excited to learn. She was excited to go to school, and she came home and would talk about it, which is not something that ever happened in daycare.
Jimenez says that daycare cost her $350 a week. Supporters of pre-K also say it could relieve economic stress for families. Joshiam Rojas, another parent at that same New Jersey school, says if it wasn't free, she probably wouldn't be able to send her son.
I will not be able to do it because it's not only him. I have another three
kids who are teenagers and thinking about college. Chris Walters is an economics professor at UC Berkeley. He compared students who attended preschool with those who didn't 20 years later.
What we found is that attending public preschool in Boston increased on-time college attendance by 18%.
So pre-K has both immediate and future benefits, but it's costly.
The primary reason we don't already have it is that it's expensive.
Steve Barnett co-directs the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. He says a national program would cost about $60 billion a year. Still, Barnett says the fact it's made it into this budget proposal is a good sign. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
Wall Street had a lot to digest today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Thank you. There's a lot to like in the macro economy right now. A record number of job openings, falling unemployment, and strong consumer spending. But there's a lot of worry out there, especially among small businesses. The National Federation of Independent Business said today its optimism index fell about 3 points in July. That's after rising for several months. Small business owners now expect lower sales and profits and worse business conditions over the next 3 to 6 months. From Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Signs of a labor shortage are everywhere. The 24-hour coffee shop around the corner from my office isn't open 24/7 right now. It closes at 11 each night because the manager tells me he can't find workers to staff the graveyard shift. Neil Bradley is chief policy officer at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
We've gone from a situation a year ago where small businesses were struggling how to figure out how to stay open to a situation in which small businesses can attract enough workers to be able to stay open.
According to the National Federation of Independent Business, 49% of small businesses had job openings they couldn't fill in July, a record high. Holly Wade runs NFIB's research center.
The labor shortage is impacting their bottom line, their ability to open as consumer spending increases.
One in five small businesses say they've lost significant sales because they can't staff up. Nick Bunker at Jobsite Indeed, which is a marketplace underwriter, says small employers are raising base pay, offering signing bonuses and better benefits, but they're at a disadvantage.
Bigger businesses are more able to give the wage hikes to attract new workers and retain the folks they already have on staff. And smaller businesses, which may have been hit much harder during the pandemic, are having a harder time competing for workers.
They're also struggling with pandemic-induced inflation, says John Cohen at Momentive, which polls small businesses with CNBC every quarter.
70% say that they are seeing increased prices in their own supply chains.
And more than a third are passing those higher prices along to their customers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You can hear more business and economic news first thing in the morning with David Brancaccio and the team on the Marketplace Morning Report. Of the nearly 4,000 colleges and universities in the United States, about 40% are considered public, as in primarily state-funded. And that funding is deeply unequal. One study from the Center for American Progress found that public colleges spend about $5 billion less per year educating students of color than they spend on white students. How it got to be that way is the subject of a new book by Atlantic staff writer Adam Harris called The State Must Provide. And as he told me the other day, the funding gap is something he saw firsthand on a visit to the University of Alabama, Huntsville, when Harris was a student at nearby historically black college, Alabama A&M.
I get to campus. Not many of the students are black. And also, it seems like the campus has had a pretty significant upkeep. You know, they had these fountains that were kind of bursting from the man-made ponds, and they had new buildings and just kind of all of the sort of accoutrement that I noticed that my institution did not have. And as I learned, as I kind of grew and started covering higher education, I learned that that wasn't an anomaly.
And your book really tells the history of how we got here, right? It was by design. Can you talk about the Morrill Act and the role it played in creating this dynamic?
Yeah. So in 1862, Congress passed something known as the Morrill Act. And effectively what this did was gave states land, which they could sell in order to fund a university and fund your college.
Was indigenous land, right?
Yes, this was indigenous land. So this was land that was taken through lopsided treaties, through violence, and stolen from natives. And so this land is sold by states in order to fund these institutions. And it basically creates a network of colleges across the country, now known as land-grant institutions. So when you think of land-grants, you're thinking of West Virginia University. You're thinking of Iowa State University, Michigan State University. Cornell is also a land-grant. But the Morrill Act had a quirk in it, and that's that Black students could not attend the majority of these institutions. But a thing happened in 1890. They passed a second Morrill Act. And that is what kind of further endowed institutions that were set up to educate Black students who had otherwise been shut out from higher education. So Alabama A&M University, Langston University, these historically Black colleges that were public institutions were able to grow from that. But I think where there's a misconception now is people often point to 1890, point to that Second Morrill Act and say this was to create and fund Black colleges. When in reality, the Second Morrill Act was actually to give more money to the predominantly white institutions who said that they needed that funding in order to better fulfill their purposes of that original act.
So not only did predominantly white institutions, or PWIs, as they're often called, get a head start, but even the law that was meant to kind of address some of those wrongs was unequal in its support.
Exactly. And that is something that we've seen time and again where, you know, there's an issue, a kind of quite clear disparity, whether that's with the GI Bill, whether that's with the Morrill Act, and how the program was meted out and where Black students fit into it. And then there's this sort of chance for redress, and it never quite adds up to the amount of harm that had already been done.
You go through the history of court cases, you write, you know, the laws that segregated higher education did slowly fall. But in some ways, tradition has been harder to defeat. As you wrote in the book, quote, "It is easy to activate the National Guard against an uprising. History and tradition are a more difficult enemy."
Yes. Thinking about the more violent battles of integration, thinking about places like the University of Mississippi, where, you know, the National Guard literally was called out in order to integrate the university to bring James Meredith onto campus. But if you look across some of the premier institutions in the country, whether that is the Ivy Leagues or the top publics, a lot of those institutions have very small percentages of Black students. I mean, The majority of state flagship institutions have fewer than 10% Black students, even in states where there are large Black populations. Those students ultimately end up going to institutions that have fewer resources. So there are two options. There's you enroll more Black and brown students at those institutions, or you fund the institutions where those students are attending.
I want to ask you along those lines about private donations. Recently, we've seen a lot of big names giving a lot of money to HBCUs, Mackenzie Scott, Reed Hastings, Oprah Winfrey. What role can or should private philanthropy play? Because that's also been a big driver of this inequity.
It has. You know, 1 year of philanthropic giving does not sort of negate the inequity in philanthropic giving over the last 100 years. You know, these institutions have things that they've needed to do for years. They have to pay for the deferred maintenance. And the fact that, you know, in a lot of cases, state and federal actors have allowed an environment where the institutions could get to a point where they have decades of deferred maintenance says a lot about the ways that America has treated Black education to this point.
And as you make clear in the book, it was the state that set up this system, enforced segregation, and then failed to enforce desegregation. There have been some legal settlements aimed at addressing some of this inequity that has added funding to HBCUs in Mississippi and more recently in Maryland. But you argue this isn't reparations. What would true reparations look like?
You know, it's difficult to say because I think that in Mississippi, you know, they got $500 million split across three colleges over 17 years when the University of Mississippi can make $500 million in 5 years of private donations. And so I think we're beginning to understand that it is going to take a lot of money to fix the issues in higher education, the issues that have been baked in, that public policy created, but it does sort of still feel like we're taking kind of piecemeal solutions to get to that final point.
Adam Harris is a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the book, The State Must Provide. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up,
multiple micro weddings in one day.
How micro exactly? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 162 points, just shy of 0.5%, to finish at 35,264. The NASDAQ subtracted 72 points, 0.4%, to end at 14,788. And the S&P 500 found 4 points, 0.1%, to land at 4,436. Looks as if casino gambling has been coming back in a big way this year. The American Gaming Association says casinos had their best second quarter in history, taking about $13.6 billion. Getting in on the action, Las Vegas Sands Corporation rolled up 0.8%. MGM Resorts and Wynn Resorts also feeling flush, both added 1.3%. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.35%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. The CDC recently extended eviction protections for most renters in the country until October 3rd. That gives state and local governments more time to distribute billions of dollars in rent relief for tenants who've fallen behind and the landlords who rely on that rent. According to the latest figures from the Treasury Department, less than 7% of the $45 billion Congress set aside has actually been paid out. Hard-hit places like Los Angeles aren't doing much better. David Wagner from member station KPCC has that story.
Kelly Lloyd is a single mom raising two kids in LA's Baldwin Hills neighborhood. She says she stopped receiving child support payments early in the pandemic. By May of last year, she could no longer afford her rent.
It has been a scary time, and we have, as a family, depended on the extensions and the moratoriums.
Lloyd breathed a sigh of relief when Governor Gavin Newsom extended the state's eviction moratorium earlier this summer.
Had the moratorium not been extended, where would that put people?
Now, Lloyd is counting on the city of L.A. to help clear her rent debt before the protections expire. She applied for the city's rent relief program shortly after it launched in March.
It's been quite a relief to know that there's help available.
For months, she's been checking to see if her application will be approved. But so far, the city has only reached out to ask her for more identification. Aside from that, Lloyd says,
I haven't heard anything yet.
More than 100,000 people applied, and most of them are in the same boat. By early August, the city had only distributed about 15% of its current rent relief funding. Landlords are also frustrated with the delays from LA's housing department. Ari Chazanis is the president of Lotus Properties.
Every time we call in, we get the same answer. We don't have enough resources. We're doing the best that we can. Be patient. This has been going on for months.
Chazana says about 35 of his tenants have fallen behind on rent. Most have applied for the city's rent relief program, and his company has submitted all the paperwork requested by the city.
Some of these instances of tenants applying go back several months without one penny being delivered to either us or the tenant.
The local need is staggering. A recent UCLA survey found that 49% of renters in LA owed some amount of money to their landlord. Add it all up, and the researchers estimate LA County's total rent debt to be more than $3 billion. Leona Rollins with the nonprofit Housing Rights Center has been helping the city process applications. She says tenants are worried about getting evicted and becoming homeless.
Some of them are so distraught, they're crying, they're like, you know,
I'm getting notices every month. I just don't have the money. We don't want them to have that concern anymore.
So why the delays? Rollins says the city often needs time to follow up with applicants. There can be a lot of back and forth, asking tenants to prove their loss of income or to show how far they've fallen behind on rent.
We want to make sure that we give everybody ample opportunity to submit whatever documents they need to make their application whole so that they can be deemed eligible and we can then coordinate with their housing provider to get that money dispersed.
The city's housing department says it's looking into hiring more people to process applications. Governor Newsom and state lawmakers have been telling people worried about eviction to apply for rent relief right away. But in LA, renters can't do that. The city closed its program in April, and it's unclear when it might start taking new applications. In Los Angeles, I'm David Wagner for Marketplace.
We told you yesterday weddings are on the rebound. The number of ceremonies scheduled for next year, almost 2.5 million, is the highest in decades. That's according to market research firm The Wedding Report. Average spending is projected to be more than $24,000 per wedding, which may be why some couples who had their festivities postponed by the pandemic are opting for something called the micro wedding with just a handful of guests. Sometimes they're even booked back to back with other couples on the same day to share costs on things like venue and decor. That brings us to today's installment of our series, My Economy, about one woman who's turned that concept into her business.
My name is Gretchen Culver, and I am the owner and creative director of Rocket Science Events and Mini Weddings based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. With Rocket Science Events, we really specialize in doing high design, high production weddings and social events with guest counts topping 300. When the pandemic hit in March, business basically came to a halt. And so I started exploring the small wedding format known as a micro wedding with typically 30 or fewer guests. And that is what is my company, Mini Weddings. And we launched in April of 2020 as an opportunity for couples to still get married, even though they couldn't have a big traditional wedding. I at first thought that this was just a temporary business that would serve these couples that had their weddings displaced by COVID. And I was pleasantly surprised that I started getting emails from couples saying, this is the kind of wedding I've always wanted to have. I'm an introvert. I don't want to have a big wedding, or I want a reason to not invite my crazy aunts and uncles. And so I pretty quickly understood that we would be, you know, plan A for a lot of couples who wanted a small wedding. Why that works really well is that it gives them the opportunity to celebrate without having a huge expense. We have multiple micro weddings in one day. And so by splitting the costs up of a wedding between four or five couples, our couples are able to have better decor with high quality vendors than they would if they were to do it on their own, paying for them individually. And because everything is designed, everything is included, that it makes it really easy for them as well. We were really excited to see how fast mini weddings took off last year, and we started selling out dates almost immediately. Our dates for 2021 are almost all completely sold out, and we have a long wait list of people who are interested in fall of 2022, so we're going to be releasing those dates fairly soon, and then, you know, don't plan to stop anytime soon.
That was Gretchen Culver, owner of Rocket Science Events and Mini Weddings in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Let us know how your economy is doing, won't you? At marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out, American workers keep churning out more stuff in less time. Productivity grew by an annual rate of 2.3% in the second quarter compared to the first 3 months of the year. That's slower than the revised 4.3% growth in the first quarter. But as Neil Irwin wrote about in the New York Times today, the recent surge follows about 15 years of pretty low productivity growth, and in part reflects recent changes in the labor market. A lot of the jobs lost during the pandemic were in lower productivity sectors, like restaurants and retail. All right, we're out of here. But first, your moment of economic context. That raise a lot of workers have been getting as employers struggle to fill jobs, well, inflation is taking a big bite out of the extra pay. Harvard economist Jason Furman told CNN, when you account for a rising prices, total compensation is actually lower than in December 2019. Before, you know... Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, and Janet Nguyen. Satara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Amy Scott. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.